All right. Good afternoon, everyone. As I think most of you know, my name's Jonathan Curtis, Assistant Secretary Research Branch here in the Parliamentary Library. Welcome to today's briefing on alternative energy. Some of you may have been here for Ian's briefing on the 16th of February on unconventional gas. If you missed it, fear not, it was recorded and you can watch it again as well. You'll find the links to both that one and today's lecture on the Library's website. Since that February briefing, I think it's safe to say that the issue of energy, its sources, prices and security have remained pretty much at the forefront of Australian public policy debate. I know that as a layman it can be hard to make sense of the many conflicting arguments put forward in the debate. So I'm delighted that Ian agreed to present a second briefing on energy and the IEA World Energy Outlook Report, this time focusing particularly on renewables. As those who attended the last lecture would know, and I won't belabour his CV again, but very briefly, Ian worked as a division head at the Paris-based International Energy Agency, in charge of analysis on global gas, coal and power markets, and since 2011 has been working on various projects with IEA, including the annual World Energy Outlook Report. Here's one he prepared earlier. He's also a visiting fellow, at the Crawford School at the ANU. I'm sure the professorship will come next. And prior to his life at the IEA, he was one of us as a distinguished Australian Commonwealth public servant. As is usual at library lectures, Ian will speak for about 30 to 40 minutes, and then we'll open to questions. So please join me in welcoming Ian.
Okay. Now, the sound isn't working too well, but we'll persist anyway. That's the book. We do this every year. 700-odd pages. I'm going to try and cover most of the key points with a focus on renewables and the electricity sector in the next 30 to 40 minutes. So hang on tight. Just an introduction to the WEO. We have three key scenarios to 2040, so 25 years out. Current policy scenario, business as usual, if you like. New policy scenario, you'll hear me talk about NPS when I slip into the jargon. Basically, that is our central case, and in particular, one of the things we did last year, 2016, we did a very careful analysis of the pledges at the Paris Climate Change Conference, COP21, and some of those in so-called nationally determined contributions, such as the US Clean Power Plan, which I'll come back to along the way if I get the chance. Our 450 scenario, which is in fact a reverse engineered scenario, which says 450 being the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere, what we need to achieve a global warming of less than 2 degrees C, and probably some of you will know that we're already well past 400 and that 450 is looking very challenging. This year's WEO focused on renewables and especially electricity, and for my sins I got to write the electricity chapter this year, which was pretty challenging. One of the things we do, obviously, when we're looking 25 years out, we need to have some grasp of technology. I'll talk a little bit about technology change, existing reasonably foreseeable technology options. We don't have any brand new, fabulous new things, but there's an important point here, and I'll come back to it again. Deployment lowers costs. So the amount we use these new technologies will definitely lower their costs, and that's an important factor along the way. But before we did that, I thought we'd have a little fun, because you've all had a pretty tiring couple of weeks, I suspect. Everyone's getting a bit tired and cranky, I know what it's like. I've worked up here for some years. So I thought we'd have a couple of little quiz questions. So my first one, China's 1.3 billion people uses how much more power than Nigeria? Now I'll just put up a few options, and you feel free to put your hand up if one of them strikes you as reasonable. First one, 10 times as much? 50? 50 times? 100? 200? Anyone care to make a guess? 50? Thanks, Jonathan. Now, I'm not going to give you the answers. You have to listen carefully. The answers will come through the talk. this is my gimmick here. So I'll just leave that one with you. Just absorb that. Second question. 1990, fossil fuels provided around 82%. Being my age, I like to look back 25 years as well as going forward. So this was one of the little sums I did. So in the last 25 years, we've done a lot of things to lower our fossil fuel use. So we've dropped it from 82% to 80, 3/4, below 70, no change at all. Anyone care to have a guess? 80. 80, okay. Well, again, I won't give you the answer. You'll have to listen carefully. And final question. So, lots of people talking about natural gas and gas markets globally, which is in Australia, that is, and globally too. Sadly, not all that well informed. So I thought I'd just throw this one in. Natural gas, how is it priced? Directly linked to oil, I've heard that talked about. On its supply and demand fundamentals, sorry for the economic jargon here, you know, like pork bellies or other commodities. Sometimes low price controlled. All of the above, that's always a good answer, all of the above. And all of the above, but sometimes in the same market. And again, as I move along, you'll get the answers if you listen carefully. So, first things, key points. A very important point, in 2015 we saw that renewable capacity actually exceeded coal, gas and oil and nuclear combined. That's a very important point, and I've got a graphic to show that, but I'll come back to it, just give you a quick oversight. I put that one, highlighted that one next, because I think it's quite a bit more important in the scheme of things. Paris Agreement entered into force last November. So within 1 year, that agreement was ratified, a major international treaty, a very rare event if you know anything about the history of these treaties. And already we're starting to see countries submit their contributions towards the 2018 review. Some of those contributions have got some interesting features. I'll get around to talking in due course. A lot of people talk about energy security. Energy to me means a little bit more than electricity. It also encompasses a few other things like oil. And some of us are old enough to remember when oil security was a big issue. Middle Eastern share in global oil production is the highest level that I've ever seen in my working life. And if that doesn't scare you, well, it ought to. Several things have happened. This situation will get worse, much worse, before it gets better. Again, I'll go into that in a moment. And transformation in gas markets. And we're seeing a very rapid rise in LNG as a portion of the total market. And finally, of course, billions remain without basic energy services. Just a couple of quick numbers to reinforce that. Ethiopia has about 85 million people and uses about the same amount of electricity as the ACT. Think about that, 300,000 Australians. Nigeria, really energy-rich country, 200 million people, 25 terawatt-hours, about one-tenth of Australia's power use. But the good news is, it's all bad news, I suppose, in a way, technology is, costs are dropping fast. A key point about our work gets frequently presented and frequently mispresented is that these are projections. They are not the future. They are projections. They are designed to highlight to policymakers where this supertanker called the world energy situation is heading. It is within our ambit to change that, and indeed over the last 5 years we've pushed our renewable projections up, just to pick one point, on the basis of major policy changes in countries like the United States and China. So there's no single story we can make this change. These are projections, as I said, on three major settings. NPS, business as usual. NPS, sorry, the new policies announced in Paris, but some of them, most of them not yet implemented. A 450 scenario, what we need to do. And finally, that business as usual scenario. So just to reinforce this point I made earlier about capacity additions, share of renewables here, fossil and nuclear there. And you can see wind, solar and other renewables taking more than 50%. And these numbers over here are gigawatts. If you're not that familiar with the numbers, Australia's total installed fleet, I guess, is about 60 gigawatts, I want to say, without much certainty. China, of course, measures its fleet in thousands of gigawatts, not hundreds. But still, this is quite an important development. That first one was capacity. This is now generation. You can see the bars down here. This is terawatt hour, and Australia is about 200. So these are global incremental additions to generation capacity. So every year the world adds between one and two Australias, more or less. And the interesting thing that you can see here is these two bars here, the importance of wind and solar happening everywhere, particularly in the last few years. And that's the total demand increase, the red line. And you can see the last 2 years in particular, almost all of it has been made up by new renewable generation. Very important change. crude oil prices fell dramatically in late in 2014. And I guess one of the things that surprises us every year, one of the jobs we do for the WEO, the World Energy Outlook, in the first quarter, is we look at investment trends. We do a survey of major oil companies. Within a few months of that price fall in price of crude, we saw investment cutbacks, dramatic cutbacks of the order of 20%, very fast, very deep. Those have continued into 2016 and indeed into 2017. So what that means is new conventional crude projects in the last 2 to 3 years have basically fallen to levels, you know, when I was a schoolboy. And, of course, given the lead times in these projects, this is starting to become a real worry, because it means down the track we're feeding the next cycle, the next commodity cycle, of supply shortages and a rapid price increase. That also applies, I might add, to a number of other commodities, even gas, where we may have a global oversupply. US tight oil, yep, it's been a dramatic story. If you followed this, and I discussed this when I was here on gas, the growth in US tight oil has been dramatic and has made a very, very significant difference to the amount of oil that the US is importing. It wasn't that long ago, 2005, the US was importing 12.6 million barrels a day, I think it peaked at. Currently it's below 5 and falling fast. It might even be probably below 4 million barrels. Not only production, mind you, but there's also some efficiency factors, and I'll come back to those in a minute as well. The US has made very impressive gains in terms of productivity. They're getting that oil out a hell of a lot cheaper than they were even a few years ago, even though the number of drilling rigs, people quote this massive fall in drilling rigs, but the drilling rigs that are there are much more productive. So, as I said, without a very sharp and unexpected pickup in investment or a rapid slowdown in growth, the next boom and bust cycle is already well underway. So enough for oil. I just want to talk a little bit about Paris. And people said, well, you know, this rhetoric that came out of Paris about leaders want to aim for it well below 2 degrees temperature change. And people say, well, you know, 2 degrees or 1.5, it's not that much difference, is it? Well, yes, it is. And I'll just give you an example, just a bit of history here. You can see here that over the last few years, I read in the Australian papers, and it's true, that the last few years have seen a relative levelling off of emissions. And having said that, and even allowing for the recession, we've still seen, in the last decade, we've seen emissions globally grow by a quarter. So the growth track is definitely up. To get to a 2 degree scenario, we've got to take energy sector emissions to zero by about 2100. And the electricity sector has to be pretty much decarbonised, i.e. zero, by, well, before that, around 2060. Now, if we want to bring that back to well below 2 degree case, we've got to get net energy sector emissions to zero by 2060, and for 1.5 degrees, by 2040. Now, in energy sector terms, that is the day after tomorrow. My little quiz question about the 82% and how much it's changed in 25 years, the correct answer is it hasn't changed at all. 25 years, we're still 82% dependent on fossil fuel. It's just a fact, but it just shows this is a very big, very complex system. It takes a long time to turn around. What we're talking there is a massive turnaround in emissions profile, especially in the electricity sector. You can see here, these are the cumulative emissions and the difference between the three figures. These are gigatons, currently. You can see current annual emissions in the 30-35 range. You can see here, this column here is only 10 years. So this is getting to be a very, very ambitious task. But I probably should have said this earlier, but our NPS submission, our NPS scenario shows significant emission reductions consistent with a temperature increase of around about 2.7 degrees. You think 2.7 degrees is acceptable, you'll be happy with current policy standards, but most of us think much more severe and much more rigorous and effective policy actions required, and much quicker. I just want to make a small point about energy efficiency, because it seems to have been, I don't think I've seen the phrase energy efficiency used once in the last 3 months in the Australian press. Just to pick an example, one of the really important things that's happened in the last 5 years is this yellow bar here, energy intensity, that is the amount of energy that the world economy uses to produce a unit of GDP, has significantly fallen and continues to fall year in, year out, even as economic growth comes and goes. This is, I said that emissions had levelled off, and they have, but some of that is structural. We're talking gas in the US and electricity changes in China, but this is structural. This is here and now. Obviously, we can do more, but it's a really important part of the energy equation, which seems to have been forgotten in some countries, and dare I say, including this one. Just to look at the bit of history in terms of the cost reductions, and obviously grid-scale batteries, solar PV, and, interesting enough, energy-using technology, and that's part of the reason why we've seen these energy efficiency improvements, is that the cost of energy-efficient equipment has dropped dramatically. We've even seen recently some drop, a fair bit of upstream oil and gas dropping, price drops, but these are the most impressive ones. Almost, okay, there's been some technology change, but I would contend that policy and long-standing, consistent government policy has driven increased deployment, which has driven increased costs. I mean, I paraphrase a German delegate, the IEA, when I was back there last year. One of the German delegates had pointed out to him that their electricity prices were very high, and his reaction was to say, well, I'm proud that the German people have supported this price fall, because Germany was one of the leaders in terms of a consistent policy to drive lower costs. So, looking a bit to the future, and just to follow up on that, these are the rough estimates that we use for costs reductions. It is, people might argue that we can do better than this, and they may well be right, but we're working on the basis of the new policies that are proposed, and we see some big reductions here in buildings. Certainly PV buildings is one area. Utility costs, even more so. We're starting to see tracking technology, for example, in photovoltaics. So the driving cost here has very important consequences, not the least being in the costs of subsidies and the cost of policies to support that transition. This is a slide I use for Europeans. Hopefully I don't need to labour it too much for Australia, but the growth has come, growth in energy back in about 2006, the OECD countries shown here, Asia-Pacific, EU and North America, that group of countries was overtaken by the non-OECD countries about 2006, I guess, and since then, of course, it's continued to grow and we continue to make that growth path. But China will begin to level off and India will start to take over the role of the growth engine. Interestingly enough, India just passed the United States last year or the year before as the second largest coal user, just to pick one example. Moving right along here. Energy trade, for some reason, seems to be of importance to Australians, so I thought I'd throw a little slide in here just to highlight a couple of points. First of all, in the case of both gas and coal, the amount of trade in those commodities is relatively small relative to the totality of coal use. A couple of years back, I got asked by an ABC journalist, wasn't I ashamed as an Australian that Australia was driving China's energy growth? And the question puzzled me completely until I realised that the journalist concerned had no concept of that because, of course, the amount of coal that China supplies to, sorry, that Australia supplies to China is approximately 1% of Chinese coal use, thermal coal use. So coal trade is a relatively small part of the total. Similarly for gas, although we anticipate that share in absolute in gas will grow, we don't see it growing in the case of coal. In fact, the growth in coal markets, you can see, is quite small. And similarly for oil, but of course oil, much greater share of trade. And therein lies the vulnerability, of course. No senators in the room? All right, very good. We can talk a little bit more about what's happening with trade there, because both gas and coal are obviously important to Australia. We've spent a fair bit of time looking at that. So, again, I love this 25-year backcasting. So when we look back 25 years, we see over that period, energy use grew by about 60% globally, and pole position was led by coal. Grew very rapidly, especially after 2001, so only really in the second half of that period. Oil growth was impressive. Gas was probably the big surprise that we didn't anticipate at the time. And low carbon, which of course a lot of that's nuclear. Looking to the future, we see somewhat different pattern. Much lower growth for coal. I'll come to coal in more detail in a moment. Oil growth still pretty slow. Gas, surprisingly, maintains its growth, mainly because of its flexibility and high efficiency, especially in end use and the power sector. But the new growth is renewables, or low carbon. Not completely renewables, I should say, because the next slide indicates that nuclear is a fair part of it, but the majority of it is hydro, wind and solar. A lot of that nuclear capacity is already being built as we speak. In fact, about half of it, I think, from memory. So, while we have a fair degree of confidence on that. And just a final point in terms of where it's coming from, China will be the new growth leader. India's in there, just there, can't read it very well. The US and Africa, in terms of that renewable deployment. Africa, as I said, a very energy rich, but delivery poor region. I can't help talk a little bit because oil and oil security seem to have been forgotten about in Australia. But when we look at the United States, and as I said, it wasn't that long ago, 2005, US imports were up here at about 12.6 million barrels a day. Currently in 2014, down to 5. By 2040, falling to pretty much minuscule levels. Most of that will come from Canada and Mexico. But you say, well, what's made that up? And oil production is certainly one part of it, but the bulk of it is actually efficiency. I think anyone who's been in the United States knows the first thing you notice when you come out of the airport is these bloody enormous limousines and bloody enormous vehicles of every description with relatively poor efficiency. So this was very much low-hanging fruit and will continue. Even modest increases in fuel efficiency, we'll see, in fact, a bigger contribution to security from efficiency rather than production. And we've got a little bit of fuel switching there, including electric vehicles. That one there on top. I should add, our new policy scenario has a number, I should look this up before I came around, about 150 million electric vehicles globally by 2040. 150 million. Currently, we have about a million, maybe a million and a half. So that's a pretty impressive expansion. To get to 450, we need to go a lot more. I'll come to that in a minute. Similar graph for the European Union and China. China becomes the world's biggest oil importer. In fact, is pretty much already there, as you can see, comparing those two graphs. And the Chinese are very worried about energy security. When they talk about energy security, they mean oil. They don't mean electricity, trust me. And the Chinese are busy building their oil stocks. And in fact, if they were an IEA member, they'd probably qualify. Requisite degree of oil stocks, and India as well, currently a pretty important oil importer, but likely to become number three by the end of the forecast period. And again, relatively, in the case of China, they certainly understand efficiency. Anyone who's been to China recently will know so that electric vehicles are starting to make a comeback. A lot of two-wheelers, of course, which are deadly if you walk in Beijing streets or indeed any city in China because they're dead quiet. And their road behaviours tends to be a bit irregular. So, what's happening with oil demand? Power generation is going south, and that's been happening for a long time. Oil-fired power has pretty much disappeared from OECD countries and is disappearing fast elsewhere. Buildings, we're looking to big efficiency improvements in oil use in buildings, plus a replacement by particularly electricity and to some extent gas, much more efficient appliances. Heat pumps. Passenger cars is probably the surprising one. That comes back to that 150 million electric vehicles I talked about, plus a massive increase in fuel efficiency standards, both in OECD, but especially in non-OECD countries. But the bad news is these are the areas that we're really struggling to do anything about on the demand side, particularly aviation, particularly petrochemicals, where it's going to be very hard to substitute for oil. Now, that has security issues, but also has environmental issues. Remember, I talked about how the emissions from the sector had to go to zero by 2040. So how do we get these sectors to zero? The answer is we have to get some other sectors to be negative. That's going to be tricky. So a little bit on natural gas. I'm chewing up the time here, but so we cast our eyes back to the year 2000, and again people are reminded a comment the IEA made about 5 or 6 years ago now that Australia was on track to becoming the world's biggest LNG exporter, but of course the really big gas exporters export by pipeline, not by LNG, particularly Russia. Russia typically exports about 160, even 180 billion cubic metres in a good year. Australia, when we get to our peak, we'll just get to 100 of LNG. So Russia, and indeed at the time, year 2000, Norway and Canada were both exporting more than 100 billion cubic metres of gas a year. Australia's gas use is around about 35 billion cubic metres, just to give you a bit of perspective. That now looks like that. In 14 years, you can see a number of things have happened, not the least being that LNG has rapidly increased its share and rapidly increased its volume. Most of that has come from Qatar. And the reason that happened, it's quite interesting, the reason that happened was that the United States was everyone who was important considered the US would become a very big gas importer. It was already a big gas importer by pipeline from Canada and Mexico. It was going to become a big LNG importer. So a lot of people spent big money in places like Qatar, Angola, Equatorial Guinea, just to rattle off a few, plus a whole collection of terminals in the US to receive the gas. And guess what? By the time they were built, the US didn't need it. The US had a massive increase in its own gas production, unconventional gas. So, ironically enough, the US will now become a gas exporter, an LNG gas exporter. That's already started the last year. First LNG's come out of a place called Sabine Pass in Texas, if you know your Civil War history, big battle there, about 150 years ago. But you can see also the interesting thing that's happening in the forecast period is the LNG will become bigger than pipeline gas. And the great advantage of LNG is it's liquid. It's liquid not just in its natural state, but it's liquid in the sense that it can move around the planet. Pipes are stuck in the ground. Pipes go from Russian gas deposits to European users. They don't have a lot of choice in using it. LNG can and will become more liquid. What's the really more interesting thing that's changing is down here is that contracts and pricing arrangements. In the past, that LNG there was priced off oil, which made sense because you're selling it to Japan. You were replacing oil. At least you were in 1980. But in 2015 or 2020, you're not. So pricing it off oil makes pathetically little sense. The LNG that comes from the US will be priced off their hub, Henry Hub, and Henry Hub is basically determined by supply and demand. So you have the situation now in already we're starting to see a surplus of LNG because this LNG was completely unanticipated 5 years ago when FID was taken on most Australian projects. Have a situation in Japan where contract gas, i.e. priced off oil, is going into Japan at somewhere between $8 and $10 per US dollars, that is, per million BTU, which I can translate into Australian per gigajoule if you like, but I won't. The LNG spot price is about half that, about $5. So you've got some Japanese buyers who are saying, well, you know, we're paying on a contract price of, we're paying $10 and the spot's $5, so what's going on here? So maybe when if someone wants to ask me a question, we can talk about how that might play out. If I really knew the answer, I wouldn't be here talking to you. I'd be out there in the real world making some real money. But so coal, that's where we were in 2014. No surprises here. China is the elephant in the room. That's being polite to elephants. It's gigantic. It's half of the world's coal, and it's been that way for some time. And very small changes in Chinese production relative to demand have very marked consequences for global trade because remember that figure I showed you where traded coal was only about 17 or 18% and up until China went from being a major exporter of coal as recently as 2003 to being the world's biggest importer 6 or 7 years later and now has reduced its, in 2015, reduced its imports by, more than a quarter. Price of coal collapsed, and then this year they started to play a bit with their internal coal market, shut down a few of their coal mines, reduced ours. Suddenly the price of world traded price of coal doubled in 6 months. So what happens in China really matters. US is number two, as I said, at least in 2014 it was India. Well, India's already overtaken. You'll see what happens in a moment. EU and Southeast Asia. When we look to the future, first of all we see China. We already believe Chinese coal use has peaked, but its decline is relatively slow. That's about 0.5% a year. The ABC, bless their cotton socks, quoted me as saying Chinese coal demand collapses. I don't think I said collapses, so just I'll labour this point. It's about 0.5% per annum decline. That's a pretty genteel decline. If my body was to decline at 0.5% per annum, I'd be really pleased. It's going quicker than that. US is doing the same. If we get time, we'll talk about Trump. But anyway, let's leave that because obviously these projections do not take into account of Trump presidency. EU, again, big reduction. People aren't building new coal-fired plants in both neither the US or the EU. And in fact, most of their coal-using infrastructure is older than Australia's, and Australia is not in its first blush of youth, as you're all well aware. Growth will come from India and Southeast Asia. You can see here, well, it's not very clear in the graphic, but India is already bigger than the US. That transition has already happened. Southeast Asia will continue to grow. I mean, there's 250 million people in Indonesia alone, 600 million energy consumers here. That is a big area. Even modest electricity growth, we anticipate a large portion of it coming from coal. Just to come back to this decarbonisation point, so I made the point here that we've seen a little flattening in the last few years, and there have been a number of factors in that. Energy efficiency has made good progress. We've seen gas in the US overtake coal as the largest source of electricity. In 2005, US coal-fired electricity peaked at 52% of US power. It subsequently fallen to 31%, and last year gas overtook its 33%. And basically that's because gas is cheap. Not on an energy basis, not as cheap, but it's a much more efficient fuel in utilisation. And China, of course, has had some major structural changes in its power sector. That's what our central scenario or new policy scenario says. A slowdown from the trend, yes, a slowdown, but nevertheless, continued growth. It needs to be there for 450. We need basically emissions to peak. Well, yesterday would have been good, but tomorrow we'll have to do very soon. And indeed, as I said before, the fall off to basically net zero by the end of the century. And some of those sectors, such as aviation, are going to be very, very hard to reduce emissions. And as I said earlier, for well below, we need to have net zero by well below 2 degrees, 2060, and around 2040. This might be self-evident, although sometimes it isn't for people. The power sector is in the vanguard of decarbonisation. Reason for that, relatively simple. One, it's one of the largest areas of emissions. Typically 40% or more of countries' emissions come from the power sector. Secondly, we have the technologies right now, and they're becoming much more cost-effective as we speak. So when we look at possible difference between the new policy and 450, this one up here, it's not very clear, is energy efficiency, very important part of the equation. Renewables, smaller contributions from fuel switching, nuclear, CCS and others. CCS, I might add, we have downgraded every year for the last 5 years. We've lowered the contribution from CCS, but it's still there. If we don't have CCS, of course, everything else is going to have to do a lot more. What that means for the power sector is shown down here. We look at 2014 emissions. In a new policy scenario, power emissions increased to there. In a 450 scenario, they've got to come back to there. Basically, this sector has to be almost completely decarbonised within the next 25 years if climate goals are to be achieved. That is a very formidable challenge. I'll talk about some of the impacts of what that means. So that's what the power sector would need to look like. That's what it looks like now globally. 23,000 terawatt hours, as I said, Australia's about 200, just to give you a bit of perspective. And fossil, two-thirds of it's fossil. And the balance, as you can see, hydro is probably the major, hydro nuclear. That graph has to change. That will grow. Electricity will increase its share in the mix. We know that from experience. As countries get richer and wealthier, more and more electricity will get used, but also electric vehicles, new uses will come in, so electrification will increase. But you can see here the unabated fossil portion becomes that much. Unabated use of fossil fuels, particularly coal, is simply incompatible with climate change objectives. It's not an anti-coal statement, it's not even an analytical statement, it's arithmetic. You can't keep burning coal at this rate, and most of that is coal, about hardly any of its oil. A fair bit of its natural gas, but a very big chunk of its coal. We can't keep burning coal unabated if we're going to achieve climate goals. And you can see these are very, very impressive increases, particularly in solar and wind. And so what investment needs to look like, so fossil fuel down here investment is basically, it's going to disappear, and renewable investment, and these are $1 trillion, I might add. And these sorts of investments can only come with a very high degree of government policy certainty, point one, and support, point two. Costs of renewables are dropping, and in some cases cost effective with replacement coal and gas, but I have to emphasise that government policy support is still needed through this transition. And the point we forget here is infrastructure, so-called transmission and distribution, demand is actually less in the 450, quite a bit less through increased energy efficiency, but we still need to spend a lot of money on transmission and distribution to get these renewables integrated properly into the system. Just to give you a quick regional overview of what it might look like in a country by country, obviously Brazil gifted with a lot of hydro. I was talking to a Swedish lady recently and she was terribly disappointed about the degree of hydro in the Australian economy, and I had to point out to her that apart from being very flat and very dry, we were perfect for hydro. Sweden's almost decarbonised its power sector, I might add, because it's basically half its power is hydro and the other half's nuclear, which is not very helpful for Australian conditions, I think you'll agree. So this is the sort of mix we can expect to see, very big increases in all of these sources, including, which you can't see it here, nuclear and CCS for a lot of places, such as South Africa for one. We anticipate nuclear being an important contributor. As I said, the price support required for a lot of these technologies, we anticipate declining as their costs improve, their competitiveness improves. So an increasing share of the new projects will become competitive. And what that means is, of course, that the policy support that we employ to support them has to be market responsive as their costs drop. The days of really high feed-in tariffs used in Germany, for example, aren't appropriate in this circumstance where we see prices drop. So that needs some clever policy design. We'll talk about that if we get time. This is globally some interesting points here. How much is this all going to cost? NPS, we've got this is a global figure, cost per unit of demand, typically dollars per 100 megawatt. This is average price globally, sort of $80. And in 2 degrees scenario, we anticipate that'll go up, but not dramatically, as you can see. And of course, demand, total demand will go down, so power bills actually won't change all that much. And you can see here the different components made up. One of the beauties, of course, of renewables, from forgetting just the absolute costs, but renewables, wind and solar in particular, can be added very quickly to the power mix. You don't have to wait 5 or 10 years to build them. Their capital costs are known, given the relatively short construction time, and their running costs are known, i.e. they're zero. So if you're a renewable promoter, you can actually build this plant with a high degree of certainty. You know your capital costs, you know your financing costs, you know, you've got a pretty good handle on your operating costs. You can offer stable prices for 20 years or more. So Jonathan's looking at his watch, so that tells me I'm going to have to skip that slide and talk very quickly about integrating wind and solar. And I try to summarise 3 chapters in 1 slide, so forgive me for being a bit superficial, but these are the things you need to manage variable wind and solar. Flexible, low carbon generation, in a number of places, Spain comes quickly to mind, that's gas-fired power. The Spanish were very lucky, they built quite recently nice new flexible combined cycle plants. Resilient, effective transmission grid. This is really important because what it means is you can do this second point, you can spread out your renewables over a big area. Think of Australia, we can have a lot of solar plants in the north when the sun's shining in the north, or maybe not, as it's currently a bit cloudy up there. We could imagine that we've got nice solar production down here. So we can wheel that power, as the Americans say, we can move it around the grid. Now currently in Australia, our grid is not very well connected. We see different prices in South Australia compared to New South Wales, for example. That's an indication the transmission system doesn't work. And everywhere that I've looked at, certainly in North America and Europe, people realise that transmission is a very important part of this. I could give you an example of Denmark, but in the interest of time, I'll just move quickly on. Storage, obviously, this is the holy grail of electricity, but in 100 and something odd years, we haven't really got an effective method for storage except pumped hydro. And even in pumped hydro, we lose a lot of the energy pumping the water up and then taking it back down, typically about a quarter of the energy, 75% round-trip efficiencies. New batteries will probably do a lot better than that, 90-92% efficiency. You need a spread of those because you need other services, ancillary services, as we call it. Demand side, interesting one. South Australia, when it had its blackout, demand was 3,300 megawatts, I think, more or less, and an average demand in South Australia is 1,400 megawatts. So when it gets hot, demand increases by 250%. So what we're doing in the electricity sector is we're building 6-lane highways when we use 2 lanes most of the time. Yeah. We can talk about that if we get a bit more time too. And of course, we need policies and market that drives all that in a least cost way and in a certain way. So moving quickly to conclusions. Energy security remains a major concern, and we're talking oil there, not talking electricity. There are a range of tools. Energy efficiency is one of them. Don't lose sight of oil security. It's still there, it's still around the corner. Those of us who can remember oil shortages know just how important oil is. Lots of sectors of the economy really run into trouble very, very quickly. Anybody's involved in agriculture, if aviation gasoline's not available, the agriculture industry comes to a stop within days. LNG, the market is changing fast, with big implications for Australia, particularly for the existing plants, but for new ones as well. Renewables, it's happening, but we still need much more consistent policy support, and it needs to extend well beyond 2020. And obviously Paris is a great start, but real government policies are needed. The new policy scenario, as I said, is not enough. So it was a bit longer than you said, but okay.
Thanks, so, questions?
Any thoughts on how Australia could improve its energy security, particularly with respect to oil?
Yep. Okay, I wasn't going to raise this, but since you have, I will. If you go into the website, well, one of the things the International Energy Agency does is require its members to maintain oil stocks that are available for emergency release. Those oil stocks are meant to be 90 days of net oil imports. People might argue the oil market's moved on, it's way different than it was, say, in the 70s or 80s or 90s. Now, those oil stocks have been used, to my knowledge, on three occasions. One was in 1991, the first Gulf War, as we called it, and members released stocks very quickly to dampen what was a very sharp price increase. The second one, it's a more interesting one, and I'll talk about a bit more if we get time, in 2005 when, interestingly enough, the Gulf of Mexico was hit by Hurricane Katrina, and apart from killing 2,000 people in New Orleans, a terrible tragedy, wiped out roughly a quarter of the United States gas and oil production. So there was an immediate crisis, interestingly enough, of diesel supply and diesel fuel globally, and the IEA members released stocks for over a two-month period to address that, and the third occasion was in 2011. Australia currently does not maintain any government-held stocks, even as our oil demand is growing and oil production is falling. I won't go into that anymore, but this, you know, it's clear. If you go to our website, you'll find how compliant Australia is. You'll see all the countries labelled green, and you'll find one country at the top labelled in red.
Yes.
Michael Billy, Department of Parliamentary Services. Yep. Network design is an incredibly complex topic.
Yep.
But mainly our networks are designed to generate electricity in large quantities, yep, distributed at high voltage with medium sort of losses. Germany, as it developed its PV system,
yep,
followed that network,
yep,
generates in large quantities and distributes, yep, it down the network.
Yep.
Australia's gone the other way. We've got all the localised PV where we're trying to generate small quantities and pump it backwards through the network. Do you see Australia reversing that philosophy over the next few years?
Yeah, okay. So Australia's networks, I guess the way I see it historically, grew up as on state basis, so they kind of start in the middle, and the power station in a load centre kind of linked close together. Think Hunter Valley, Sydney, think Melbourne, the Latrobe Valley. Interconnects between all those areas are weak and have stayed weak since the NEM was formed. Investment in that large-scale transmission infrastructure has been weak, and that's one of the second point I highlighted there, the importance of that quality transmission interconnect. So if I was to make one suggestion, in terms of the Australian context, I'd certainly say have a look at that transmission infrastructure. The fact that power can be twice the price in Adelaide as it is in Melbourne tells you something about the ability of electricity to move in that direction. Clearly, there's an old joke about the Holy Roman Empire. They say there's neither holy, certainly wasn't Roman, and definitely wasn't an empire. Well, the national energy market is actually certainly not national, certainly not a market, and energy, well, it's actually about electricity. So, yeah, it's a bit like that. It does need a lot of modification. I'm not 100% certain I agree with your characterisation of what the Germans did. Some of their ideas, their feed-in tariffs were extremely generous, they were very effective, whether they're efficient or not, and whether their distribution system can cope. What they have been doing is exporting and importing power because they do sit literally in the keystone state of Europe. they move power in and out. The case of Denmark is one of the examples I made. Denmark is a 40 terawatt hour economy, exports 15 terawatts, imports 15 terawatt hours of power. So you see a very large scale transfer. When the wind's blowing, they push power out in every direction. When the wind's not blowing, they suck it in. So transmission in those two examples is extremely important to maintain system stability. Of course, if you were planning a new grid, you might actually think, well, if I'm going to build wind, where are the wind spots and where are the solar spots? And you might want to put those lines, those grid lines, maybe, you know, along those places rather than putting them right through the major demand centres, which might also might be a good idea as well, which we haven't done. Of course, we got lucky in South Australia in that there's a main 275 kilowatt line completely by accident from Port Augusta to Adelaide, and it happens to coincide with an area of very strong wind. So if you go to look at the wind distribution, you see that 275 volt cable and see all those wind farms along it. Great stuff, except when the cable goes down, of course.
While people are thinking, you mentioned the ideation sector in particular. Are there any feasible renewable alternatives for the aviation sector? Because as I understand it, there's still, in spite of the very significant increases in the efficiency of jet aircraft, the quantities are rising rapidly. Do we have any alternatives?
Yeah, well, I mean, the obvious alternatives, and you know, funnily enough, defence agencies are pretty interested in this, are biofuels, and the US is doing a lot of work on biofuels. The issue with biofuels is, of course, sustainability. Is there enough biomass out there to feed and clothe, you know, the planet and still turn some of it into energy crops? And, you know, I'm old enough to remember the day when there were organic chemists who were saying we won't have to grow food in the next 50 years because we'll be able to synthesise all the food we need from oil, and which is true. You can make all kinds of things from oil, but here we are 50 years on saying, well, actually, we're not going to be able to use oil, so we're going to have to take food and turn that into fuel. Get my drift here. So, yeah, things... ideally, of course, you use non-fuel crops. You try and use waste crops, lignocellulosic conversion. There's one technology that's been around for a while but still struggling to scale up. Hydrogen, you know, we can make hydrogen from natural gas or electrolysis. Again, it's energy inefficient, but hydrogen's certainly one potential. The great thing about hydrogen is the light. It's voluminous. Volume's not so much a problem for aviation, but weight definitely is. The light fuel is good. So hydrogen's certainly there, but at the moment we don't have any alternatives. We don't have any proven commercially available alternatives to the aviation sector, and that's a little bit of biofuels has been used by a few airlines, but by and large, not the large-scale alternatives we have in, for example, the electricity sector.
Yes,
I've been to a lot of sort of conversation today alone, and it seems to me that the technology is fantastic, but people have the first economic and behavioural things.
Yep.
If aviation is taking so much energy, why aren't we, instead of getting frequent flying public transport, instituting a cut in the beach?
Like a carbon price, I mean. Yeah, look, I mean, energy efficiency involves, you know, I said there's a big wedge at the beginning, and I talked a lot about energy, a bit about energy efficiency, let's talk a little bit more about it then. Energy efficiency entails a lot of things. Yep, technology change would be something about these lights. These ones don't look too bad, but can certainly be better. Just, you know, lighting, standby appliances, a lot of things we can do, air conditioning. Buildings, in general buildings are still terribly inefficient in the market phase. Some of that's technology, some of it's behaviour. All of those things have to be brought to bear. Anyone who's worked with energy efficiency, you need a mixture of incentives. We need some regulation, minimum energy performance standards we've had in Australia for about the last 20 years, gradually getting tighter and tighter. Vehicle efficiency standards have to be A, regulated and B, enforced. The latter part's been a bit worse lately. Some aspects have to be mandatory, some have to be behavioural, some have to be cross-driven. But the energy efficiencies, that's where the low-hanging fruit is. In the case of aviation, market incentives are pretty strong to deploy that, to deploy best practice technology, but at the same time, vehicle fleets take time to turn over. You only go look at the car fleet in Australia, you've seen cars running around that are 20, even 30 years old, maybe not so much in Canberra, but certainly if you go to Bankstown, you'll see plenty of them. Adelaide, where I come from. So, you know, these fleets take time to turn over, and this is a slow process, which is why we need to start now and then take a really broad-based approach to energy efficiency. There's some good examples out there.
My question was just around the 2040 renewable ideal scenario. With the sort of mix that was in there, I was just wondering about system security with the non-synchronous nature of the sources. So what is actually, it's probably talk about the inertia and frequency control, is that only coming from hydro and storage, or is it from the actual inherent change in the infrastructure that it actually won't be as volatile then?
Well, all of the above, yeah. Certainly, I think we've seen a good demonstration that when you bring wind into the grid, if you read the AMO report yesterday, there's a whole range of technical changes which they've suggested, which some outside observers looking at it just overnight had an email from Paris saying, colleagues over there saying, you didn't have these cut-off standards in place already. Spanish colleague of mine. The Spaniards discovered this some time ago. They got very high penetration, 30 gigawatts of wind, I guess. It's 20-25, so it's pretty high. So they discovered these things a while back. So, yeah, system security can be addressed with a whole collection of small technical fixes and bigger use of paint batteries, as I said. Large, small, medium, large scale, some residue. CCS, we've got CCS in the mix there, and of course that's CCS, gas and coal fired, mostly gas actually, rather than coal. Do provide all our systems to energy services as well. But you know, we've got a completely different grid. We've got a much more distributed grid. The grid of 2040 and 450 scenario is dramatically different.
I'm just wondering whether internationally you've seen any groups and groups of community, micro groups or community energy players being separate?
Yeah, I mean, I think again we come to Northern Europe, and if you look at I think Northern Germany, Hamburg region, Denmark in particular, a lot of cultural issues here in terms of Scandinavian culture, obviously. Much more cooperative. You see it, microgrids based on biomass. Denmark's a big producer, pork producer, really good pork producer. Very efficient, very mechanised, clean, beautiful, produce a lot of biogas, a lot of waste. And waste disposal is a big issue, and again, we're figuring out that. Any large scale production of meat or pork or chicken produces a lot of bio waste, and it's been one of the key ways they've stabilised wind. It's a small place, and 40 terawatt hours, not really big, but having that 5 or so terawatt hours of biogas based power generation, but also direct use of biogas in those local areas, very important to stabilise the market. And of course, tax heating load, certain gas, based on Denmark, it's a high heating load, it's important to use that heat, their manageability of that heat, to manage the heat. So that's another aspect of stability there is used where consumers have heat or cool. If you turn the heat off for half an hour, at the end of the world, it's fine. It's the hot, the cold, fine, comes back on again. So, how do we value that? How do we incentivise that? That Denmark's done quite well, but in other countries, we still get the grips with the fact that if you do have a peak, and you cut people off, for say 10 minutes or 20 minutes or so, just one particular appliance, not everything, just say air conditioning. Technology certainly existed now. In most cases, people have air conditioning, so anyway. But yeah, you can control demand, that's one of the points that we've got there about demand side exercise. Hardly see that anyway. People will use the quickness switch to what's going on. Well, guess what? The air con might go off in 15 minutes. You might even sign a contract with your distributor saying, I'm happy to have my air con cut off for 20 minutes or half an hour at a time, but you can achieve the rate, thank you very much. Bear in mind, I said that air conditioning load. That's run for 100 hours a year, those high loads. 8,600? We've got economics.
So, time for one last question, I think.
Yeah, I was just actually going to ask you about the time being involved in management.
Yeah, the short answer is I think you've got to get in and do it. You've got to convince consumers they're not going to be picked off by the system, and trust is, to be honest, trust is high in a lot of places at the moment, not just in Australia. So, yeah, you'd have to trial it, you have to demonstrate that it can work, how it works, it's required, how much good the smart metering infrastructure costs.
effectiveness, certainly yes, particularly at residential level. And liver demand is not just residential, it's commercial, industrial demand, some of those industrial processes. And indeed, that's one of the things happening in New South Wales. We saw autonomous more than 4 hours. You know, that's the classic demand style management. If you're only in the soil, 4 hours production is still trivial. They might have been a smarter way to do it at a much more decentralised level. And certainly the technologies available, dare I say, the software and the wetware, except to make it happen. It's a way to attract a lot of leadership from utilities and governments, trial it, make it happen, show what works, admit what doesn't, fix what doesn't, move on. Well, some of those things are tough.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think on that note, we're out of time. One of the great aspects of this job is getting to invite in and listen to people like Ian, who clearly know their stuff from a lifetime, a whole career of working in great detail at a high level in their particular sector. Another very, very interesting briefing. He's safe from a third invitation because he's fleeing to Paris in the not-too-distant future. But I hope we'll again be able to have future briefings from you at some stage when you return. For those who want to follow up, you can, of course, as I mentioned, listen to the briefing again on having been recorded. If you're really keen, I'm pretty sure the library will have a copy of the World Energy Outlook report somewhere in the stacks.
Yep. You can download a little executive summary for those of you. Trouble with the executive summary to me, it just raises more questions than answers, but that's just a personal comment. It's pretty tough to take 700 down to 8 pages. So.
I think Ian will probably stay around for a few minutes afterwards if you have any questions you want to put to him. And you can put those questions to him over a cup of tea or coffee if you'd like, so please join us for that. Otherwise, please join me in thanking Ian for presenting.
Right.
My mind's bogged.